Welcome back, my friends. Dr. Ken Berry here with you once again. I have the distinct honor of having probably one of the most learned individuals that I've ever had on this channel. It's a great honor and privilege to welcome Dr. Thomas Seyfried. He has taught at Yale University, Boston College. He has over 150 published papers and book chapters dealing with cancer. And the fact, in my opinion, that cancer is at least predominantly a metabolic disease. It is not a genetic disease to any meaningful degree. And we're gonna talk about this at length. And we're live in my private group. And so our 5,400 members are going to have first dibs access to ask Dr. Seyfried questions. And as I see a good question roll by, I'll pull that up and we'll take questions from the tribe members and we'll hear what Dr. Seyfried has to say about that. So without further ado, Doctor, welcome. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you very much, Ken. It's nice to be here today.
Excellent. So let's start this. I've already kind of spoke about your bona fides. Let's get started with how are we doing in the war on cancer? Let's just start from a 50,000 foot perspective. Are we winning the war on cancer? How do the rates of cancer, the incidence, what about survival? Tell us where we're at in this war on cancer that we declared decades ago.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. You know, every year the American Cancer Society comes out with their report card on the war, how we're doing. It's published generally in around January, end of January, early February, projecting for the following year. And year in and year out, we're getting more dead people. The incidence is increasing much faster, of course, than the number of dead people. But the number of dead people per year is also increasing. So right now, if you look at the latest statistics, it's about 1,670 people a day are dying from cancer day in and day out.
In the United States.
In the United States, yeah. And different countries, of course, it all seems to be linked to the number of people in the population. So Chinese, I think, has about 8,100 people a day dying from cancer because they have a much, much larger population than we do. But it seems like everywhere in modern societies, let's put it that way, Western societies, cancer incidence and deaths are continuing to elevate. And, you know, we look at all this information. And as I said, breast cancer now, according to the most recent from the American Cancer Society, has now replaced heart disease as the number one killer of American women. So it's always been predicted that at some point cancer is going to surpass heart disease. Well, it's creeping. It's biting at the heels of heart disease. Already for breast cancer, it's surpassed. And I think in the next several years, you're going to see it surpass all. It'll be the number one cause of death for people in Western societies.
That's crazy. And for years, I've told women, because, you know, the breast cancer lobby or whatever you want to call it has had a great marketing success. Mm-hmm. And so many women would come to me at the clinic and be worried about breast cancer. And I would have to redirect them and say, no, you really, what you need to be worried about is heart disease, because right, that actually has a greater chance of killing you. And so what you're saying is if the rates of cancer incidence and death keep increasing, I'm going to have to modify my advice to my femo patients to say, no, you're right. Cancer is that is the number one killer.
Yeah, and it comes from the American Cancer Society. They're the society that's logging the dead. You know, that's predominantly what they do. They have a very sophisticated statistical staff that keep track. And it's very hard. Susan Wadia Ells, in her book Busting Breast Cancer, went through and how difficult it actually was to collect statistics on the number of people dying from cancer, breast cancer. And she finds it also ambiguous from the American Cancer Society is how they actually get these numbers. It may even be bigger and greater than what we actually think it is. It's very hard to get these kinds of numbers. And because sometimes people take a drug or something and kills them real quick for cancer management. Did they die from? So what the term is often used, died from the complications of cancer. And when you hear died from the complications of cancer, which you hear quite often, that's when the drug cancer drugs killed the patient before the tumor did. So whenever you hear died from the complication, and that's not an that's not a rare statement. It's not rare. When you say the individual died from the complications of cancer, means the treatments killed them.
So
between that and the number of people actually dying from the disease, you know, you have a lot of people here.
And a lot of people are not aware of this. And to put it, kind of use, you know, general language, chemotherapy is poison. And any oncologist will tell you this. And so the goal of chemotherapy is for the chemotherapy to be slightly more toxic to the cancer cells than it is to the human. And so the goal is to kill the cancer cells before you kill the human. But in many cases, with a misplaced calculation or either of the dosage or of the patient's ability to tolerate chemotherapy, chemotherapy can be a deadly poison. And I'm not advocating against following your oncologist guidelines. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying you have to understand that's what it is. It's just hopefully more poison to the cancer than it is to the patient.
No, that's true. That's true. And some people die real quick because their bodies are so sensitive to this chemo. And then the people that kind of survive are the ones that are the most resistant to the chemo. So, I agree with you 100%. You're poisoning somebody.
Yep.
You know, why would you want to do that? Why would one human being do that to another human being? It's kind of malpractice, if you ask me, especially when you have other approaches based on hard science. why are we doing that when we don't really need to do it?
And so there is hard science that strongly supports that cancer is a metabolic disease. But if you talk to any oncologist, any health guru out there, what's going to roll off their lips is that cancer is predominantly genetic. We don't really understand, you know, a lot of it's idiopathic. It just happens. We don't really understand why. Maybe there's radiation insults. Maybe there's, you know, I was taught in medical school that it was a multi-hit phenomenon, that, you know, you got a little too much radiation, you were exposed to the wrong chemical. Maybe often diet wasn't mentioned, but you and I both know that's a big deal. But with enough hits to a cell, to the DNA in the cell, then boom, there you go. Now you have a cancerous cell. And I was going to ask this question later, but I think it's pertinent now. Obviously, from the data you just relayed, we're losing the war on cancer, or at least we're not winning.
Yeah.
And the predominant theory or model or hypothesis is that cancer is a genetic disease. And every day, all of us see advertised on television and in magazines, this new cancer therapy, this new drug, that new drug. But why are cancer researchers and oncologists, why are they so resistant if they're not winning, right? Because if you're winning, you don't want to hear anything else, but we're losing. Mm. Why are they so resistant to thinking of cancer as a metabolic disease, to looking at the over 150 papers that you've published and other people have published, Otto Warburg, why are they so resistant to that, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's, as I say in many of my it's a dogma. It's an irrefutable truth, a silent assumption. When the leading scientists, several have received the Nobel Prize for their work, driving the research juggernaut industry from the National Institutes of Health, as well as all of the National Health Service from England and all of the national health organizations throughout the world in Western medicine have bought on to this idea that cancer is a genetic disease. And the dogma has become solidified in textbooks and lectures, and every major textbook of science that the students will read, cancer is a genetic disease. If you go to the National Cancer Institute website right now and look up what cancer is, you will see a big sign: cancer is a genetic disease. So the National Cancer Society, NCI, and the NIH deal out thousands and thousands of research grants every year to scientists all over this country and other countries, studying gene sequencing, looking at mutations in various types of cancers. We have an industry now with immunotherapies, which is a new form of treating cancer, the Opdivo, Keytruda, all these things you hear on TV. They're all based on the somatic mutation theory of cancer. So it has become an irrefutable truth, something that's no longer questioned. So the established science field views cancer as a genetic disease. The folks, as you mentioned at the beginning, the folks on the street don't know. They're not. They just assume that the guys running the National Institute of Cancer, that the Dana-Farber, MD Anderson, Sloan Kettering, all these guys can't be wrong. How could they be wrong when they're treating thousands and thousands of people? All the textbooks say it's a genetic disease. NCI says it's a genetic disease. The Germans, the Japanese, the English, the French all say it's a genetic disease. And we come along and say it can't be a genetic disease. The evidence is overwhelming against it. And yes, they would just as soon not listen to it. The pharmaceutical companies are already bracing for a $1 trillion industry in the future based on the cancer as a genetic disease. So this is a momentum. It's some sort of incredible momentum that is ending up brutalizing tens of thousands of people being tortured and treated by strategies that are not based on the hard science. What I have simply done is peeled back the layers of the onion and looked deep into this nature of the disease. Why was Otto Warburg thrown under the bus? What was wrong with him? I looked at that. And then I did research myself over and over again, coming back to the fact that Otto Warburg's idea was absolutely correct. And then what we did is we went back and we showed where Otto Warburg at that time did not have all of the information that we now have. We were able to go back and show exactly where he made errors in his calculations and his assumption, but he was absolutely correct on what caused cancer. And it's the disruption of respiration within the cell. I showed, and others, that the ROS are produced, reactive oxygen, radical oxygen species, that are carcinogenic and mutagenic. So all of the stuff that is majorly thought to be genetic is actually, it's there. It's not that we don't have mutations. The problem is their effects. They're not the cause. So and then once you realize the cancer cells cannot live without fermentation metabolism, in other words, they can live without oxygen. Okay, they're the only few cells that live without oxygen. The rest of us are all dependent on oxygen. So when you say, how are these cells living without oxygen? They're using ancient fermentation pathways. Then what do you need to drive an ancient fermentation pathway? You need two fuels only. We showed the sugar glucose and the amino acid glutamine. We interrogated the cells. We went through every kind of a food that they could eat, and we can't find anything other than these two fuels. And then when we test that on preclinical systems, we kill the cancer. I mean, it's not perfect yet, but we have enough humans, dogs, and mice to say that we can manage this disease quite effectively by targeting the fermentation metabolism and transitioning the whole body over to a fuel, ketones and fatty acids, that the tumor cells can't use for energy. And this puts a kibosh on these tumor cells, and you don't have to use radiation, chemo, or any of these other kinds of things if you do it the
right way. One of the main problems, when it's obvious to the person, the average man and woman on the street, that we're not winning this war on cancer. It's obvious. And the danger is that when any big organization that's supposed to know is not doing a good job, what it causes to happen is conspiracy theories. And, Gina says they do not want to heal cancer. This is a $1 billion industry. I've heard conspiracy theories that they've got the cure for cancer. It's locked away. They've got the fact they're never going to release it. I know that's not true. That's what happens to just normal people on the street when they see, oh, these guys are so intelligent, and look at all these drug ads on television, but yet more and more of my friends are getting cancer. That's the kind of atmosphere that breeds conspiracy theories. And I we have a lot of healthcare providers that watch my channel. And I want you guys to, if you're a healthcare provider, you need to understand that when you act like you know exactly, and you, this is the way, and there's, I can't be wrong. And yet it's obvious by looking, oh, my aunt has cancer, my sister has cancer, my next door neighbor has cancer. You obviously don't know what you're talking about, and it spurs these kind of conspiracy theories.
No, I agree that you would think a person who wouldn't know would think that would be the case, because I've seen many people tell me, oh, it's suppressed. Well, I'm telling you exactly what it is.
Yes.
You're not suppressing it.
Right.
The federal government isn't suppressing it. Well, the pharmaceutical companies aren't suppressing what I'm saying. They're just simply ignoring it. It's just, so it's not like there's no conspiracy here. What it is a lack of knowledge, a disregard in wanting to know. Everybody seems to be very, very comfortable in their niche. This, what I'm saying, comes along and it causes a great deal of discomfort because people are now going to have to perhaps do something different. So you have to realize that the NIH grants and all the funding and all this kind of stuff is continuing to do research on something, approaches that are not core to the problem that we're dealing with. And therefore it becomes very uncomfortable to try to change the momentum of the ship. All you have to do is go back in history and look at other situations like what we're confronted with today with cancer. I look at the geocentric versus the heliocentric explanation for the movement of celestial bodies. You know, for decades and decades, the Catholic Church held, yes, that the Earth was the center of the solar system. Giordano Bruno, the Italian scientist, was burned at the stake, killed. He became a martyr of science by telling the church that they might be wrong. It was Copernicus released his statement about the heliocentric theory that the sun was the center of the solar system on his deathbed because he didn't want the wrath of the church to eviscerate him. Galileo was house arrested for his life for saying that Copernicus was correct. And then Kepler came along and said the planet movements are completely explained by Copernicus and Galileo. Eventually, the church said, yeah, maybe you guys are right. But it took a long time because you challenged the authority of the central dictate at that time. The church was the center of knowledge and a discipline for the sciences. So, and same with Louis Pasteur. He was eviscerated by the French medical aristocracy for claiming that germs rather than bad air was responsible for disease. So I'm coming along and I'm telling you that cancer is a mitochondrial metabolic disease. It's not a genetic disease. And I consider this just as important as the shift from the heliocentric to the geocentric to the heliocentric, because we have 1,600 people a day dying from this misunderstanding or the failure to address the situation. I consider this even more important because whether you believe the earth or the sun were at the center, it wasn't killing 1,600 people a day for your disbelief. Maybe just Giordano Bruno, but not all these poor folks that are dying needlessly, are suffering, are horrendous. We don't have to have this. You know, it doesn't have to be this way. And what I'm saying doesn't require a genius to figure out how I'm going to cut calories, stop eating highly processed carbohydrates, and transition my body over to ketosis. You don't need a degree in advanced engineering from MIT to know about this. So the change is going to have to come from the people themselves. If they're the ones that want to do better, they have to put the pressure on their politicians, on the medical schools, and things like this, because they're not going to change unless the customer makes the demand to change.
I totally agree with that. Now, you brought up glucose and glutamine earlier. Let's talk about this. I made a video on this channel a few years back titled Cancer Love Sugar. And I talked about how we attach sugar to the molecule in a PET scan. That's how we find cancer, because the cancer is ravenous for sugar. It'll take it up quicker than any other human tissue. And that's why cancer glows on the PET scan. That's how we find it, is by using sugar for it to seek out the sugar. So does cancer love sugar? And if so, what is the immediate implication for the average person who would rather not get cancer?
Yeah, well, I think when we say sugar, the cane sugar is one part glucose and one part fructose. And it's the fructose that actually accentuates the sweetness. It's the glucose that the tumor cell loves. So when you eat sugar, it gets broken down and the glucose immediately goes into your bloodstream and goes right to the tumor cell. Here's the situation. The tumor cell is locked into a dysregulated growth. And that's what the definition of cancer is. People say, what is cancer? It's simply cell division out of control, not complicated. Cells can't stop growing. Okay, in order to grow, you need two things. You need energy and you need raw materials. You need something to build new cancer cells. So the carbon of the glucose comes, and the cancer cell is garnished with all these transporters for glucose. So the glucose comes pouring into the cell, and the glucose carbons are metabolized to a smaller three-carbon molecule called pyruvate. Now, in the normal cell, we all take in glucose in our normal cells, and it goes into our mitochondria as pyruvate, fully oxidized in our mitochondria. We breathe oxygen, and we generate tremendous energy through the process of oxidative phosphorylation. We exhale carbon. Well, a lot of the carbon that comes out as CO2 was the carbons from the foods that we ate. Okay, so we're eating food and a lot of it comes out, and the water. So the waste products of normal metabolism are simply CO2 and water. The waste products of cancer cells are lactic acid and succinic acid and glutamic acid. They're dumping out acids. They're not dumping out CO2 and water. They're dumping out acids. Why is that? Why would the cancer cell dump out acid? Okay, because it makes the microenvironment acidifies. When you acidify the cancer microenvironment, chemotherapies, radiation therapies, it becomes much more difficult to kill them. So they're dumping out the acid because they can't respire these molecules using oxidative phosphorylation. The mitochondria is broken. But the mitochondria can also generate energy through this ancient pathway of fermentation using glutamine. It's an amino acid. And that glutamine generates nitrogen for making new DNA and RNA and protein. It makes ATP for energy. Without energy, nothing can grow. So the glucose is coming in one pathway. The glutamine is coming in on another pathway. And these two pathways are powerfully synergistic with each other. So the carbons from glucose are used to also make DNA, also protect the cancer cell against reactive oxygen species, but also allow the cancer to make proteins and lipids. So you get the nitrogen from glutamine, you get the energy from the two pathways, and the cancer cell is growing unregulated, continues to grow. So the only way to really effectively shut down this whole system is you have to take away the two fuels that these cells are absolutely dependent upon and transition the body over to a fuel that the cancer cells cannot use, which is a ketone body or fatty acid. Why? Because you need a good mitochondria to burn fatty acids in ketone bodies. The mitochondria of the cancer cell can't do that. This is not complicated. This is not complicated. I find that the guy on the street can understand this better than the guy running the National Cancer Institute. Can you believe this? I mean, it's just like, I find it astonishing.
And, you know, that's my point. That's where the conspiracy theories come from, because when you say something like you just said, that's a revolutionary statement. That is inflammatory as all get out. How can you even say that the people at Sloan Kettering or the Cancer Institute, how do they not know? How is that even possible that they don't know that?
Yeah, I think a lot of them do. Okay. I mean, a lot of them do. But then they'll sidestep the situation by saying, oh, yeah, we all know cancer cells have a screwed up metabolism, but it's gene driven. It's under the gene control. No, it's not. Damn, I published a paper showing that it can't be. So that's kind of a protective. And the guy on the street doesn't know. What does he know? He's not reading the papers like I'm reading the papers every day, you know, looking at this. So it's a sidestep. Yeah. Oh, we all know cancer is metabolic. No, you're going to everybody go to the NC. Oh, yeah. Cancer is metabolic, but gene driven. No. Not gene driven. It's mitochondrial driven.
When someone's been diagnosed, with cancer and they go to their oncologist and the oncologist says, okay, we're going to set you up for chemo and radiation. And then after every chemo treatment, every radiation treatment, they give them a glass of OJ and they give them some cookies, some snacks, some crackers. They're actually not doing their patient any favors.
No, that speaks to the fact that they lack knowledge. Okay, if you were understood the biology of the disease you were treating, you would never, ever do something like that. Okay, so if an oncologist says, oh, don't worry about it. Eat anything you want while you're undergoing these treatments, that person lacks knowledge. That person should not be in the position they're in when they say something stupid like that. Okay.
I like this guy more every sentence. I like him more and more. So Roxana makes a great point. In modern times, we don't burn people at the stake or eviscerate them anymore. We just destroy their career if they say something revolutionary like you're saying. What about?
I'm old enough to not worry about that.
Excellent. I'm glad. I love it when somebody stops caring about their career and starts caring about, hey, let's just help men and women.
Well, you know, a very funny thing, Ken. I get a lot of positive feedback from physicians that have retired, but not as many of the guys that are working on the day to day. You know, they say, I know you're right, 100% right. But man, when I was working, I couldn't say anything about it. But so that tells us, you know, what I think the system prevents people from stepping off the path. They could lose their license. And there's a lot of reasons for this. It's not just one reason. I mean, I train so many kids to go to medical schools and they don't get any information on nutrition, diet therapy. They don't know how to use diet as a medical tool. They're just simply not trained and they never heard it before. And then all of a sudden patients come in off the street and tell the doctor, I think I should be on a water fasting for some time before I do this. What are you talking about? You know, what do you know? You didn't go to medical school. I'm the one who paid all that money to go to medical school. I know what I'm talking about. And a lot of times they do. I mean, if you're going in for a hip replacement, knee replacement or something like that, those folks know what they're doing, you know, but when it comes to cancer, it's a totally different ballgame. Most of those poor folks are clueless as to the very biology. And the guys at the NIH and at big hospitals, they're all running trials on drugs that are all based on the somatic mutation theory of cancer. And if the somatic mutation theory of cancer is not correct, then the stuff they're giving you is not ultimately going to be the solution to the problem.
Consequently, I totally agree. Yeah.
You got 1,600 people a day dying every day in the country from a lack of knowledge and a resistance to change the system.
Now, one thing that cancer researchers, oncologists, and almost everybody in the healthcare field knows for a fact, Dr. Seyfried, is that red meat and processed meat cause cancer, or at least increase your risk of cancer. Has that been really mapped out so that we know that conclusively? Red meat causes cancer. What do you think about that?
It's bullshit. I mean, it's absurd. We evolved as a species.
Tell us from your learned perspective, how is that bullshit? And why, if it is bullshit, why in the hell are they saying this?
Because, well, first of all, we evolved in the Paleolithic times to kill and eat animals. If we didn't go out and kill and eat animals, we would not today exist as a species. No one was growing corn, wheat, or any of that time. I mean, you were hunter-gatherers. The Plains Indians would follow the buffaloes around. These are the aboriginal kinds of people. You would kill whatever, Africans, bushmeat, you name it. Whatever walked or crawled, our species was able to eat. Would we eat a vegetable if it were a ripe fruit? Of course. We're omnivorous. We can eat anything. If you eat meat every day that is hormonally prepared, not natural, you could put yourself at risk for some kinds of problems. Oftentimes people aren't sitting down and eating 4 pounds of meat. They got a big potato, a bowl of rice, and some bread with butter on it right next to it, followed off by something else. So you have a high fat, high carbohydrate diet. That's not good. Our ancestors had very little opportunity for highly processed carbo and zero. The ultra processed carbo foods didn't exist. And Albert Schweitzer, the great humanitarian physician, found that in the African tribes, there was no cancer. They never found cancer. The Eskimos, they said, oh, Eskimos are completely resistant. Eskimos never get cancer. So all of the Aboriginal tribes of our ancestors, don't forget, they're all our ancestors.
Yes.
They had no cancer. So where the hell did all this cancer come from? Eating red meat? No, it didn't come from eating red meat. It came from eating highly processed carbohydrates. That's the origin of cancer. And what does that do? It elevates blood sugar. It damages oxidative phosphorylation. The obesity epidemic is evolution in action. What you're seeing is that our genes are so, our genetics is so tuned to store energy. If we weren't able to store energy in the form of fat, we'd have been wiped out on the first ice ages and things. Famines would have wiped us out. We're supremely geared to store energy. Now, all of a sudden, we find ourselves in a totally different environment, eating highly processed carbs, getting fatter and fatter, more and more cancer, dementia, cardiovascular disease. It's a epidemic of chronic diseases because of our diet and lifestyle. So clearly, it's diet and lifestyle that are doing this, right? And we're targeting cancer cells by depriving them of their fermentable fuels, which are made abundant by our diet and lifestyle.
Absolutely.
So, people have to understand this.
Now, go ahead, doctor.
No, I just said, if they don't understand, and again, people always say about prevention. Nobody cares about prevention because we have an obesity epidemic. If everybody cared about prevention, you wouldn't find any fat people around. I mean, like our ancestors. You think we had 300-pound guys walking around in the Paleolithic period? No, they're all short and fit and tough. You know, they didn't have the body weights, the sizes and things that we have today.
Absolutely. And what Dr. Seyfried is saying is exactly correct. I've made it my mission over the last several years to really dig into the archaeology literature and the anthropology literature and even the paleoanthropological literature. And before 200 years ago, now maybe not even that long in some cultures, cancer was just literally unheard of. There would be one person in the village that got cancer, and that was it. And when we look at the fossil evidence, there's just no indication that cancer was anywhere nearly as ubiquitous almost these days. And so, yeah, he's exactly right. There just was no such thing as cancer. And people that looked at kind of sequestered cultures like the Inuit and like the small tribes scattered around South America, Africa, Australia, that were eating an Aboriginal diet that was as much meat as they could possibly get their hands on. And then they would fill it in with tubers and nuts and berries and other things. Yeah. Cancer was just non-existent. Yeah. And so it has to be something in the modern society. Yeah. Now you say a very interesting thing, and this is going to get very nerdy very quick. You say that cancer progression is Lamarckian, not Darwinian. And I've read enough animal biology and evolutionary biology to know what you mean by that. But I want you to explain to the average person, what do you mean by such a statement?
Yeah, it's a very interesting from Lamarck, who preceded Darwin. Lamarck was of the opinion that things changed. They were not rock written in granite. Like everybody appeared exactly as they were. He said there was opportunities for change, an evolution. But he attributed to your environment, you acquire certain things in the course of your life, and those things are then passed on to the next generation. He felt that had some level of credibility. The blacksmith's arms were big, could bang in this, and the sun did that. But it was the cultural thing that also could contribute to that as well. But we're really now realizing these kind of epigenetic things that are happening in one generation can in fact modify things in the second generation. Even though Lamarck was also thrown under the bus in light of the Darwinian evolution. But what I said in cancer, how I was able to integrate a Lamarckian view, was that when cancer initiates in the first cell or group of cells in a particular tissue, in a particular organ, it's usually the result of a chronic irritation of something that would provoke an inflammatory situation, damaging the oxidative phosphorylation capacity in the cell. Never enough to kill the cell outright, but enough to injure that cell, enough to elicit a slow compensatory fermentation. Because if I damage the OxPhos2 critically, I kill the cell. But if the cell has the capacity to slowly upregulate a fermentation, it gains the ability to survive under lower and lower oxygen, eliciting a growth, a cell division, if you will. At first, the cell division is very, very slow. The organelle that controls the cell cycle is, in fact, the mitochondrion. The mitochondrion in the cell controls the cell cycle. That the differentiated state of the cell in our liver, our kidneys, wherever it is, we have cells that perform a vital function day in and day out. They're not dividing. Only they would divide if they had to be replaced. And it's a very regulated division controlled by the energy of the cell, which is the mitochondria. So if we have cells that the mitochondria become slightly injured, these cells then start to lose, the cell starts to deviate from its differentiated resting state. And each division that goes by, if the chronic irritation is not removed and persists, the cells slowly do a little bit more division, slower and slower eventually. So what happens is that when the cell divides, that damaged mitochondria is passed on to the daughter cells in the mitotic activity. So each cell division passes on to some degree some damage in that mitochondria. It's acquired. As the cell becomes more and more fermentative, the microenvironment becomes a little bit more acidic. And what happens is the mitochondria become more and more damaged from the acidity in the microenvironment, and they pass on damage from one generation to the next. It's an acquired damage in each division that happens. Now, also, at the same time, those reactive oxygen species coming from the acidification also cause mutations in the nucleus. So the nucleus is gaining mutations, and the mitochondria are being passed on damaged. So it's an acquired continuation of damaged mitochondria and mutations in the nucleus, all of which are building to a greater and greater extent. So by the time you look and see your cancer identified on PET scan or however you see it, you already have millions of cells that are dysregulated in their cell growth. You look, you take a tissue and you say, look at all the mutations that you have. Now we're going to try to target your mutations because you've accumulated these. But if you look at the mitochondria in those cells, they're all blown out. They're dysfunctional. Okay. So how did that happen? It happened through an acquired passing on of these damaged mitochondria from one cell division to the other, with the damage accumulating over time, leading to what eventually becomes known as a malignancy. So the cells are no longer in their growth. They can't be growth regulated because the very organelle that regulates their growth is dysfunctional. So the controlling system of the cell has lost its control. And now it's growing out of control. And the more it grows out of control, the more the mitochondria become damaged, but the more they begin to ferment glutamine. So it's an interesting situation. So once you understand the beginning, the progress, and what you get eventually see, and why and how, you know how to stop this. You know how to kill it in its tracks.
So let's talk about the glutamine, doctor. You mentioned glutamine earlier. That's an amino acid. And, and immediately a lot of people are saying, oh, amino acid, that's protein. So we need to eat a low protein diet, need to avoid meat because it's got amino acids in it. Yeah. Is the glutamine that you're talking about, is it endogenous glutamine or exogenous? Is it coming from the diet? Is the body making it? Teach us about the glutamine.
Yeah, glutamine, it's called a non-essential amino acid, okay? But it's absolutely essential for a lot of things. It's essential for the tumor. It's essential for our immune system. It's essential for our gut. The reason why it's non-essential, because we can make it from glucose. So you can make glucose to glutamate that can eventually make glutamine. So there are some amino acids that are absolutely diet related. You have to have them in the diet, whereas other amino acids can be created within our body. Glutamine is an interesting amino acid. It's the most abundant amino acid in our bloodstream. So a glutamine dominates all the other amino acids. I mean, you're up at about 3 or 4 millimolar in the blood. So it's there for so many reasons because it feeds our immune system. When we get an infection, our macrophage, T cells and B cells are all heavily dependent. Our immune system is heavily dependent on glutamine. So you can't just get rid of glutamine. Our gut health is dependent on glutamine. The urea cycle is dependent on glutamine. So glutamine is everywhere. There's no diet that you can use to target glutamine. If you are burned, if a patient is burned severely, they get glutamine injections. You give a glutamine injection to a burn patient because you need the immune system has to keep out the bacteria. Bacteria are prevented from entering our body on our skin. If our skin is burned, staph, strep, all this stuff enters in our body. Our immune system has to fight these bacteria. Otherwise, the patient is going to die from infection. So you give high-dose glutamine because the amount of glutamine in our bloodstream is not enough to satiate the demand for glutamine for our immune system. So you give high-dose glutamine to the burn patient, some sick people that have, you got to have your immune fighting. So we need glutamine, but the tumor cell needs the glutamine as well. So you have to use this press pulse concept that I developed where we choke off their glucose because our bodies don't need glucose. We can burn fatty acids and ketones to replace the glucose. Okay, yeah, the press pulse concept. So what we do is we target glutamine availability with drugs for a short period of time. Okay, so what's going to happen? Here's what's happened. The tumor cell, if you can choke off his glucose with the ketogenic diet or fasting or lower the blood sugar in a variety of different natural ways, you come in with a drug and you hit that glutamine availability just for a short period of time. You come in with a one singular dose at one time. It's called doses, timing, and scheduling. You slaughter a whole buttload of these tumor cells. But then you got to pull that drug back. Because if you keep it on, you're going to paralyze your very immune system that's needed to remove the corpses. If you kill a whole bunch of tumor cells in a particular organ at single time, and then you don't come in to pick up the corpses, you could run an internal inflammation. You could get all kinds of other issues that are going to stand in the way of the therapy. So you come back off on the glutamine, let the immune system, because the immune system isn't killed by the glutamine targeting drug. It's simply paralyzed. It doesn't kill them, but just makes them ineffective in picking up the corpses. So you have to pull the drug back, hold on. It's unbelievable. I mean, this is really, really nice stuff when you really know how to work with it. And you let the immune system pick up the dead bodies. And of course, some of those cancer cells will grow just a little bit. But as soon as you pull it back and you hit them again with the glutamine targeting, and you don't do so much. Patients don't have to lose their hair. They don't have to lose all this stuff. So what we do, like you can see here on the diagram, the guy comes into the clinic. Not only does he have cancer, he usually has all kinds of other maladies, type 2 diabetes, parasite infections, imbalances, metabolic imbalances. So we have to bring that person back into some normalcy of metabolic homeostasis. We got to get that guy back in some level of shape. And we start hitting them with ketogenic restricted diets, zero carb diets, water only fasting, this kind of stuff. Blood sugar goes down, ketones go up. The guy starts to feel a little bit better. Then we come in with the pulsing. So, and we also use stress management, you know, music. People are all stressed out with cancer. So their blood sugar is high because of the cortisol. So you have to be careful. Excuse me. I got to drink some water. I get so excited about this. I can't talk.
I love it.
So what happens then? We bring this guy to a managed state. It's not so critical now. So how do you feel? I feel pretty good. You know, the guy says, hey, I'm feeling all right. You know, I'm a little hungry maybe, but my energy is coming back. I don't feel so bad. And then we strategically target slowly by dosage, timing, and scheduling. We can bring that guy. Now, some of these people that we work with, they stay in the yellow zone for long periods of time, which means that their cancer is not resolved. It's just put into a dormant state. Their quality of life is pretty good, but they always got the angel of death looking over their shoulder. So they say, whoa, geez, you know, I got to be careful about this. I, you know, every time I do a PET scan or a CAT, I see something there. but I feel good. You know, I'm not crippled. My quality of life is pretty good. And they could stay in that semi-managed zone for long periods of time. It's the green zone, which is resolution. That's the point where this guy's been going for so long. The only way we can know resolution is if someone at say 45 years old, 50 years of age, has a malignant cancer. We put it under metabolic control, never knowing whether he's fully resolved or not. He dies at 98 from old age. The cancer never came back. Okay, he was cured. But other than that, you would never know. So
it takes a minute to figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, do you want to live longer with a higher quality of life? That's what you have to ask. People have to ask themselves. Now, is this 100% effective? No. Is it better than any of the current therapies? I would say yes. Okay? You're not going to lose hair. You're not going to bleed from all orifices of your body. I mean, I don't know anybody who had hyperprogressive disease from ketogenic metabolic therapy. I know a lot of people who've died real quick from immunotherapies. Well, hyperprogressive disease where the drug kills you before the tumor can.
And so, if you're right about the ketosis and the dropping the sugar out, if you're right about the science behind that it's going to be virtually impossible for the cancer to ultimately be victorious. Now, this is an interesting question.
Wait, Ken.
Go ahead. Always, yes, sir. Go ahead.
Not always, because some people fall. They say, that would happen to our first GBM patient. She was under complete control with metabolic therapy, and we did the scans on her brain, complete gone, you know, everything. We couldn't see any with a CAT scan, or MRI. You couldn't see anything. But that doesn't mean the cancer cells weren't there. As soon as she got off metabolic therapy, she went out eating high carbohydrate foods. It came roaring back. So she passed away from taking Avastin, which that should be outlawed. Anybody who gives Avastin is malpractice. I don't care what anybody says. I've seen enough of that to be no, that doesn't work. It can actually hurt you in so many ways, and yet they give it to these poor folks.
I've got a question coming up about the cancer treatment medications, but JM says she was diagnosed having the BRCA1 gene. And as you know, many women will have a preemptive mastectomy. They will have their breasts removed, thinking that that's necessary to prevent breast cancer because they've got this gene that guarantees that they're going to have breast cancer. To talk to us about this, if someone has a family history, like, oh, mom had breast cancer and they checked her genetics, she's got the BRCA1. I've got it. Should I have a mastectomy?
Yeah, great question, because that's a secondary cause of cancer, not the primary cause. Okay, there's a BRCA1 is penetrant. That means if you have the gene, what is the probability that you're going to get cancer from the gene? It's about 55, 60%, sometimes 45%. But that means there's 40 to 50% of the women that have the mutation never get cancer. So a primary cause is when you have the defect, and that defect is always associated with neoplasia. What is always associated with neoplasia is mitochondrial dysfunction, oxidative phosphorylation dysfunction. Now, what's interesting is that the women who have BRCA1 who get cancer, that BRCA1 in some way has damaged oxidative phosphorylation capacity. So the linkage is BRCA1, OxPhos deficiency, cancer. But 50% of women have this BRCA1 that never get OxPhos deficiency. We don't know if that is, that could be called epigenetic effect. There's another gene that represses the BRCA1, or there's something in the environment that doesn't allow BRCA1 to damage the oxidative phosphorylation. So it's a risk factor. BRCA1 is considered a risk factor. Like if you're exposed to a tetrahydrochloride or a chemical, it is a risk factor. People constantly exposed to chemical carcinogens increase their risk of getting cancer from exposure to the carcinogen. Does everybody exposed to the carcinogen develop cancer? No. It's a risk factor. BRCA1 is a risk factor, but it's not 100% penetrant. The gene that's the highest level of penetrance is the leaf-romeni disease. It's a P53 mutation that affects cytochrome C oxidase 2 in the mitochondria, I believe, and it disrupts oxidative phosphorylation. It's about 85% penetrant. So only 15% of people that have the mutation don't develop cancer. But again, it's a risk factor, a very high risk factor. BRCA1 is a medium risk factor. Now, what people can do, what people do, like Angelina Jolie and some others, the actress there, they had their breasts and ovary removed. Those are the organs that are most likely to develop a cancer if BRCA1 becomes penetrant and damages oxidative phosphorylation. Had Angelina Jolie done metabolic therapy as a prophylactic and not had her breasts and ovaries removed, we don't know. The other thing, too, is having breasts and ovaries removed doesn't mean that that BRCA1 will not be expressed in some other tissue at some later point in life. You just don't know. So I think people, at least if you know it's a secondary risk factor and not a primary risk factor, then what can you do to prevent, to reduce the probability that the BRCA1 will cause cancer? You can lower your risk by knowing what you should do in a prevention way. I mean, we've looked into this in depth. We have not found any inherited mutation that's 100% penetrant. As I said, Li-Fraumeni is the best. Then they have these others that are about 5 or 10% penetrant. So you have
a woman in these shoes, she finds out she's got the BRCA1 gene. If she said, no, doctor, I don't want a preemptive mastectomy and oophorectomy, I would rather just adopt and stick to a therapeutic ketogenic diet that's going to keep me in ketosis for the rest of my life. Would that be a rational decision on that woman's part?
Well, you can ask my good friend Dominic DiAgostino. He's always in ketosis. He's not a woman, but the fact that he's always, his body is always... If Dominic gets cancer, man, I'm throwing the towel in.
Right.
That guy is like in ketosis all the time. He eats only the healthiest stuff all the time. He's always got low blood sugar, elevated ketones. I mean, he is in that kind of a zone. Now, a lot of people, it's very hard, let's be honest, to be in that zone in today's day world. I mean, every time you turn around, there's something that's going to throw you out of that zone. I mean, the smell of a freshly cooked pizza, a donut coming out of the oven, a big loaf of bread. Oh, man. I mean, you say, oh, man, if I eat that bread. Well, you can take a bite as long as you can get back. That's why we built the glucose ketone index calculator. It's a tool to allow people to know whether or not they're in ketosis. And Dom is always like in the low, I think he's below 10, 5, 2, like this. And I know he and I had a contest one time. I had one student that was really, really good on water-only fasting. And women seem to get lower GKIs than men. They have better, they can mobilize fat out of their bodies easier than men, I think. I don't know what it is. But anyway, they always seem to. So I had this one young lady, and she got a GKI of like, I think it was like 34, which was a point 34, lower than one, which is really, you know, really 0.34. So you're have higher ketones than higher glucose. So I took a picture of it and I sent it to Dominic. I said, Dom, look at what one of my students can do. He said, he writes back, is a very impressive. So the next week I get an email from Dom with the glucose ketone meter, and he said, beat that. So what Dom did, listen to what Dom did. He knew now he was being challenged. So he went 4 days water only fasting, and then drank his he makes ketones. He has a company that makes ketones. So he drank this ketone solution, and he brought his blood sugars down to 25 milligrams per deciliter, which most clinicians would say, oh, you should be dead. He has ketone levels were up around 6 or 7 millimolar, and his GKI values were like a 0.18 or something. And I'm saying, oh my God. He said, beat that. Well, I know. And he was fine. Well, I have a paper here, which is really quite interesting. You don't have this one. This is an interesting paper by Drenick's group. So what Drenick did.
Show that paper one more time, doctor.
Yeah, it's a paper published by Ernst Drenick. Can you see it there? Yeah. Can you see it there, Ken? I don't know where you went. Let's see. Anyway.
My viewers are funny. They love to look stuff up and actually read papers.
Yeah, we'll have them read the Drenick paper. Nothing more exciting. So what Drenick did is he took these morbidly obese folks, 9 obese subjects They all had hypo. So he fasted them for 21 days. I think it was 21 days. Water only fasting, 21 days. And of course their blood sugar go down and their ketones go up. And then he gives them a high dose shot of insulin. He brings their blood sugar down. It says right here, 9 milligrams per deciliter. Deciliter. 0.5 millimole. That should kill everybody. None of these guys perfectly cognitively okay. Why? Because the brain was burning ketones now. Ketones replace glucose. So you can push those glucose levels. People say, oh, you can't bring the glucose levels down. Why don't you read Drenick? He did it in humans.
Yeah, you definitely can do that. And indeed, many of our followers, my wife, Nisha included, when they're in deep ketosis, they'll very often see a blood glucose of 45. And they're like, but I felt completely fine and normal. And I'm like, in the setting of ketosis, that's not dangerous. Now, here's another great question. This is Debbie. She was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer. And I don't know exactly what therapy she had, but she's now adopted a ketovore diet, which is by definition less than 10 total grams of carbohydrates a day. And she's also taking several of the medications that's recommended by mainstream medical practice. Is her dietary intervention, is that a smart move? And obviously none of this is medical advice. We might be doctors, but we're not your doctor. What do you think about her adopting a ketovore diet, super low in carbohydrates? She's going to be in ketosis the majority of each and every day. And then what about all these medications? Any other names pop out that you have any comments on?
Well, first of all, I don't know what her GKI value is.
Right.
I mean, we got to know what her GKI is. So her glucose ketone index. Like I was just talking about Dom and my students and things, we're all measuring the GKI. So you could be eating a diet that has very low in carbohydrates, but what is your GKI? Is because a lot of these drugs that you take are brutal. They can raise blood sugar internally. Your gluconeogenesis could go through the roof as the result of this, throwing you out of a good GKI. I don't know. So what we do. Our plan for cancer management is we first bring the patient back into a state of metabolic homeostasis, get the GKI at 2.0 or below. And then we hit them with glutamine targeting drugs. Now, the drug that I think works best is 6-deoxynorleucine, DON, D-O-N, Delta, Oscar, November, 6-deoxynorleucine, because there's no diet that will lower your glucose. Well, actually, that's not completely true. George Cahill of the great Joslin Diabetes Center found that a 14 to 18 day water only fasting will lower your blood glutamine. But, you know, Don can do it much better. I don't know why we're not allowed to use that. You should be able to get it on Right to Try. Johns Hopkins is building a variant of this drug, but the drug works best when glucose is reduced and when the drug is administered in a ketogenic diet. That just knocks the crap out of these tumor cells without any toxicity. So why are we not doing that? I can't speak to these other drugs that people are taking. I don't know what they do. All I know is if I had cancer, I would never take any of that stuff. That's my personal opinion.
Gotcha.
You know, I would never.
Yeah, I think that speaks volumes.
I don't take anything poison. I don't take any drugs at all. Maybe some wine and beer, but other than that, I don't take any drugs.
Now, Roxana's got a great question. What would you consider the minimal reading for ketosis to either prevent, or if somebody's been diagnosed with cancer, what would you love to see their ketone readings on a serum ketone level to know that, yes, you're doing a good job at protecting yourself from either getting cancer or from metastasis?
Well, let's talk about prevention first, because it's a different story. You have prevention. What do you so look at Ken, just like you said at the beginning, no one was around 12,000 years ago to measure a glucose ketone index on our Aboriginal ancestors. But we do have, as you said, some of these Aboriginal peoples that are living on their own lifestyles, if we can find them today anywhere. What's their GKI values? Because I'm sure they were all on the low side because there wasn't any carbohydrates in their diet. So I think, and we know they don't get cancer. Eskimos never got, they never got cancer. They didn't get have cancer. So what was their GKI during that period of time? They had no highly processed carbohydrates in their food chain. It was all natural meats, berries, nuts, whatever they could find, they would eat it. So that would prevent. Obviously, those people never got cancer. So clearly they were prevented from getting cancer. So I don't know. Now, as far as having cancer and then trying to get into a that's what our press pulse strategy is. That works with the person that has cancer. How can we bring their body back into metabolic homeostasis? And as I said, we did it with the dog that we just published the paper showing how that dog completely, cancer was completely eliminated from a malignant mast cell tumor just by diet, changing the diet and calorie restricting the natural diet. Just blasted the tumor off the dog's face. So, and a lot of people are showing me similar evidence.
Yeah, I read the paper. It was a moving Twitter post that you made. The before and after picture of the dog snout was just amazing. Let me ask you this. You brought up Dom D'Agostino and his ketones. Do you think that in the treatment of cancer, that exogenous ketones play a meaningful role versus the endogenous ketones that we can all create ourselves just by eating a very, very low carbohydrate ketogenic diet?
Yeah, I think so. And that's like, it's like a supercharger to something you're already doing yourself. My concern, and I think you'll have to talk to Dom about this, is, you know, what are the best exogenous ketones? Because there's a lot of stuff on the market that's not right. You know, everybody wants to jump into this stuff, trying to, you know, the salesman's kind of stuff. Some of the stuff is bogus. You really should have no sugar at all or sweeteners. You got to really reduce a lot of this kind of stuff. Always double check your glucose ketone index yourself. Use the Keto Mojo meter that you can buy on Amazon. Everybody should have one, I think. You know, a lot of health nuts are all guys are lifting weights and they're running and doing all this stuff. They're measuring their GKI a lot now. I made it for the cancer patients. I wasn't making it for CrossFit people, you know, but they're using it to say, look how healthy I can get when I have my sugar low and my ketones elevated. They get into this new Paleolithic state of existence and they feel like they're going to go out and, you know, wrestle down a buffalo, you know, or something. I don't know. These guys are... Yeah, yeah.
Can you spell Drenig? Mitzi's trying to look this paper up.
Drenig. Yeah. Here it is again. Let me see how I can get it here. Can you see it there? Drenig. Ernst Drenig. Drenick.
Thank you. Perfect. Yeah. Perfect.
And this was published in the 1972, the Journal of Clinical Investigation, which is a top medical journal.
Excellent. Now let's talk to the man and woman in the street, Dr. Seyfried. They've listened to our discussion and they're like, okay, so what are the five simple things that I should do if I would like to slash my risk of developing cancer? And indeed, what can I do for my family to decrease their risk of cancer? What about my friends, my loved ones, my neighbor across the street? What are the four or five or six or seven just basic things that you need to stop doing or start doing that are going to have a tremendous effect on lowering your risk of developing cancer?
Yeah, well, I think since we know what causes cancer, we would try to avoid the risk factors that cause cancer. And I think the singular biggest thing is ultra-processed carbohydrates in the diet, okay, which is everywhere. You know, I heard that from Ireland, you know, the Subway sandwiches, right? Subway sandwiches. They looked at the Subway bread, the bread on the sandwich, and the Irish deemed that it cannot be called bread. The level of sugar in the bread was so high, they had to call it a confectionery.
Yes.
And it's like putting meat between two donuts. You know, this stuff is going to kill you. Now, not to say that if I eat a Subway sandwich, I'm going to die. No, of course not. It's like how frequently you do this and what does it do to your basal metabolic rate? What does it do to your BMI, your size? What does it do to your blood sugar levels? You know, there was an interesting paper published within the last few months with the Mediterranean diet, where they looked at like 40,000 people over 10 years or whatever. And they found that their obesity, cancer, and dementia were significantly reduced by a Mediterranean diet. It wasn't the Mediterranean diet. The Mediterranean diet did not have highly processed carbohydrates in it. Right. It was the absence of the things that cause all these problems. So if you can avoid, and exercise is extremely important. You know, this is and the problem is this: these foods are so tasty. Last year I had a McDonald's hamburger for the first time in like 3 years, because the kids were upset. They needed some food. We had to get off the highway. The only thing there was a McDonald's. So I said to my wife, well, we'll get one of these things. I hadn't had one in like 3 years. I said, I ate this McDonald's. It was so damn good. I was trembling while I was eating it. You know, it's not like they're making it so you can't eat it. The best things that you like are, you know, not to say that, you know, a McDonald's hamburger is ever going to kill you. Of course not. But the problem is, it's the constant barrage on your body of highly processed carbohydrate foods clearly is the number one risk factor for dementia, cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. Almost all the major chronic diseases are coming from what we're eating, right? I mean, not hard, but it's the eating the stuff that we love the most. And it's also cheap relative to healthy stuff. So, you know, folks that may not have a means and they're living hand to mouth, I mean, this may be the only nutrition they get. And they put themselves at risk, unfortunately. And they have all of these kinds of problems. It's really our society, our Western civilization. The evidence is so overwhelming. You know, cancer comes because we're the ones eating. And as I said, the pharmaceutical company and the federal government are not forcing us to eat high carbohydrate foods.
That's true.
They might do a better job at letting us know the hazards. They certainly let us know about smoking, yes. Right? But someone eating and gorging themselves on hamburgers is not putting you sitting next to that person at risk for getting diabetes, where secondhand smoke could. Therefore, the society went into a big thing. Cut down secondhand smoke. We stopped smoking. We made it, you know, not right to sit and put someone else's life at risk.
Yes.
However, when you consider the burden on our healthcare industry and the very lifeblood of this country going into taking care of people that have abused themselves by eating all this stuff, all that billions and billions of dollars going into cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. Think if we put that into education, roads, the military, all kinds of things that would benefit our society. And yet we're throwing it into people who are no fault of their own, just driven to eat all this crazy stuff. So it's a societal thing. People just need to be aware of it. I'm not telling people don't eat McDonald's and donuts and Subway sandwiches and all that. Just know that there is a risk in doing that all the time and not exercising. If you're not exercising, you're sitting around on the computer, you're going to get fat, you're going to get demented, and you're going to get diabetes, and you're going to die earlier than other people who don't do that.
Another thing in the modern diet that there was none of it, zero, is industrialized processed vegetable seed oils, canola, yeah. Soybean. In your research and in your reading, have you seen a connection with the inflammation that I believe is caused by the industrially processed vegetable seed oils and rates of cancer?
Yeah, well, I don't know enough about that to speak to because I haven't done any studies on seed oils. So I don't, you know, our job is to kill off cancer cells by depriving them of their fuels. You know, I'm not looking into whether eating seed oils gave you the cancer in the first place. All I know is if it's the highly processed carbohydrate foods, maybe seed oils can make them worse. I don't know, but certainly it's not going to be, in my mind, the number one issue. Not to say that they're healthy, they're unhealthy. I mean, you can cook and fry a lot of stuff in these oils, which probably aren't the best thing for you. But if you have that blood sugar elevated, you're gonna lead to systemic inflammation. Seed oils may push that a little bit further. I don't know, but
gotcha.
But you know, how many people? How are you gonna chug a bottle of seed oil? I mean, give me. I mean, I don't know what people are doing out there. You know, I don't eat seed. I mean, maybe fried foods are in seed oils, right? But you know, it's just these kinds of things.
I got you. So your number one recommendation for just the average man and woman walking the street, if you want to slash your risk of developing cancer, you need to eliminate highly processed carbohydrate food.
Not eliminate them, but significantly reduce them.
Gotcha. And then what about your overall carbohydrate intake on a daily basis? Would you recommend a low-carb diet, a ketogenic diet on a daily basis to reduce the risk of cancer?
Well, I think, as I said, like you said at the beginning, what did the Aboriginals do? They never got cancer. So they never had any highly processed carbs. That's their society. Every time you turn the corner, we got a fast food store on the corner. It's convenient. It's easy. Think about what we're doing today. We're all on the run. We're sitting in traffic. How many millions of our citizens are sitting in traffic, not exercising? And they run home. The kids are in school all day. The husband, the wife, they're both working. What are they going to do? Sit down and say, okay, let's go out in the backyard and slaughter that goat. We're going to have him tonight. No.
right. And so what I do when I'm going to pitch. Yes,
we got DoorDash now. They even come to you. They drop the food off.
Absolutely. But you know what? The customer is in charge of what they actually put in their mouth. And so when I'm in a pinch and I go by McDonald's, I'll get six or seven of the quarter pound hamburger patties and then some of the zero carb mustard. Yeah. That's what I eat in a pinch. I never eat the fries or the bun.
Yeah. It's the fries and the buns that make it so good, though.
For some people, yeah. But you know what? What tastes better to me than eating the fries and the bun and the sugar-laden ketchup? Yeah. Not having cancer. That tastes better to me long-term.
You know, people all roll the dice. You know, we're all hoping we never get cancer. It's just the way life is, man. You're just going to, all of a sudden I got cancer. Now what am I going to do? Now that's where our metabolic therapies come in. To take care of it, bring your body back into a state of a homeostasis, and try to beat it naturally. I've seen so many people do so well. They seem to go down the tubes big time when they get all that radiation and chemo, and all this crazy stuff that we're doing to these folks. When I'm not saying we eliminate all that stuff completely, but man, I tell you. I just think there's other ways to go about doing this. I wish the establishment would recognize the science supporting what I'm saying.
Absolutely. What would be your number two and number three recommendation other than get rid of the highly processed junk, eat a low carb diet? What's number two and number three?
Well, I mean, exercise for sure. I mean, we've got to get back to our species did not sit around all day. I mean, if you're hungry, you had to go out and get your food. You know, DoorDash did not exist in the Paleolithic times. So there was a lot of work and energy, the fires. I mean, it was just energy. We had to do things. Today, as I said, we're a lot of couch potatoes, sitting in traffic, sitting in front of a computer. You got to get the stress that's coming from this constant visual bombardment. People walking around with the headphones. You know, we evolved to be in nature all the time. We heard things, we saw things, our brains were geared for an environment that was oftentimes hostile, whether it was going to be an animal or one of your own members of a species trying to kill you. You were always in an environment where you needed to be aware. Otherwise, you're going to be food for something else. And, you know, I always tell my students, if you're going to put headphones in, do it when you're studying or relaxing. Don't be running around. Outside, these kids get run over. They're in a different world. They don't even know their environment. They're depriving their brain of the very stimulation that we evolved to have to be who we are today. So, you know, it's just a lot of it's just common sense, man. I don't know what else to say.
One final question. In the ketogenic community, when you say things like, cancer loves sugar, okay, and it's going to thrive and metastasize if you're eating a high sugar diet. I always get, especially on Twitter, some smartass always comes back and says, well, there are cancers that can live on ketones and fatty acids. And I love your opinion on that.
I tried it. We've been busting our ass trying to find a tumor cell that can live on fatty acids and ketones. That here's the situation. When those guys publish those papers, they give them fatty acids and ketones. And, oh, the tumors look like they're growing. And what else do those tumor cells have access to? Glucose and glutamine. Okay. Huh. There is no one out there that has shown me a cell that can live on fatty acids and ketones without any glucose or glutamine in the environment.
In the studies, they were giving them ketones and fatty acids, but they also had access to glucose and glutamine.
Absolutely.
That seems a little disingenuous.
Yeah, well, they didn't know. They don't know. They don't know that the glucose and glutamine are the fermentable fuels. So, and not only this, listen to this, Ken. Fatty acids are very interesting. So when cells like the brain take in fatty acids, they actually uncouple. That's why we don't burn too many fatty acids in our brain, because uncoupling causes heat. We have a skull that will keep heat inside. We'll get heat stroke. So the brain doesn't burn very much fatty acids. It burns glucose and ketone bodies. But other tissues can burn fatty acids. But if you give a lot of fatty acids cause mitochondrial uncoupling, okay, which leads to heat. And when you uncouple, mitochondria, the cell uncoupled, will suck in more fermentable fuels. So the fatty acids themselves are not eliciting cancer. They help the cancer cells get more fermentable fuels, which makes it look like the fatty acids are doing it. They can't. You show me some guy who has a cell. I've been looking. I busted the ass of my students here. Find me. We're interrogating all these cancer cells. Okay, you put them in. Glucose and glutamine, they're fine. You take out glucose and glutamine, they croak. Then we go through all the different fuels that we can see what they can rescue. No, fatty acids and ketone bodies cannot rescue a cell in the absence of glucose and glutamine.
So to sum that up, there is no known cancer cell line that can thrive and metastasize on ketones and fatty acids.
In the absence of glucose and glutamine.
I think we're going to end on that note right there. That is a grand slam if I've ever heard one. Dr. Seyfried, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Yeah. If you're watching this on YouTube, this was recorded live in front of our private community. They had a chance to ask questions directly to Dr. Seyfried, who was gracious enough to answer those questions. If you want to become a member of the tribe, there's a link down in the show notes to sign up. Doc, I feel like we could talk about this for another few hours. I need to have you back on in a few months, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, we'll see how all this information settles. And we're also in the process, very close now, to submitting our treatment protocol for cancer. We've been working on it for several years now. We want to overturn the standard of care, what they're doing to these poor folks, and giving them a real how-to manual for all oncologists, all physicians that treat cancer patients the way they should be treated.
Absolutely. I love it. I can't wait to get my hands on a copy of that. Thank you so much for taking the time, Doctor. Have a good rest of the day. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.